This podcast was recorded on Thursday, March 16th at 11:15 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like the Fed will step in to bail out investors in Norfolk Southern.
Buy low now while you still can.
Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those snollygosters or shrewd politicians who eliminate regulations and then wonder how train accidents and bank failures happen. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, quick updates on the Abortion Rights Amendment and the piling on of Norfolk Southern.
It certainly is a piling on. But first, it has been a week now since a federal jury found former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder and lobbyist Matt Borges guilty of racketeering in the state's largest political scandal ever.
You know the story. Householder funneled $61 million from First Energy through a dark money group to get himself elected speaker, then passed the billion-dollar bailout of First Energy's nuclear power plants, and then fight off a repeal effort.
The trial featured riveting testimony, a brutal cross-examination of Householder, and secret recordings. The man who provided one of those recordings, the conversation that probably led to Matt Borges' conviction, is Tyler Furman. He was working on the campaign to repeal the bailout when his friend and mentor, Borges, offered him money to relay inside information to the enemy, the campaign defending the bailout.
And that's when Tyler called the feds. And Tyler Furman joins us now on Snollygoster. Tyler, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's just start with your feelings right now. It's been an incredible 4 years for you. The investigation is over. The trial is over. Householder and Borges are now convicted. What is the weight on your shoulders right now?
The weight on my shoulders, honestly, it has been lifted. I don't know that I've ever felt more relieved at hearing a piece of news. Last week when they came out with the guilty verdict, it's actually kind of a funny story. I was wrapping up an interview with Anna Staver from the Columbus Dispatch. And at the end, she said, who knows, maybe by the time we're done, we'll have a verdict. I hung up the phone, got a call from my best friend, who was the first person I called when all of this began. And he said, I'm going into a meeting and I can't talk long, but I wanted to let you know they just came with a guilty verdict for both. And I got off the phone. I was in my truck and just sat and took a deep breath, may or may not have grabbed a few tissues, but the feeling of extreme relief.
Wow.
Was just overwhelming.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Let's go back 4 years, Tyler. Back in 2019, seems like ancient history at this point. Yeah, you are an advocate for renewable energy. You were working on the campaign to repeal the nuclear bailout law, and your friend and mentor, Matt Borges, offered you a proposition. Take us there. What happened?
Yeah, so I was in between opportunities, and honestly, when I was offered the chance to go work on the repeal campaign, Matt was my first phone call. I called him and said, this is what I'm being offered. I know you're on the other side. I don't want to harm our personal or our professional relationship. And his answer was actually very kind. It met the same level of rapport that we had for years. He said, no, that's business. It's politics. We'll be on opposite sides sometimes. In fact, you should really do it. He encouraged me towards it. And shortly after things got underway and I was out in the field, he asked me to meet him for coffee. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. I'd stop by his office. I'd give him a phone call. We'd text back and forth. And so I agreed to it. And at first it was just kind of, how are things going? How are you liking it? How are you feeling? And I was like, you know, just talking with him about kind of what was happening on the campaign. There wasn't anything nefarious at that point, but then the conversation shifted and he immediately started telling me that he would like to know how many signatures we had gathered, how many, or what our progress was, where the canvassers and petitioners were located, and other inside information about what I was doing on the campaign. And then went even further and tied that to an offer. And the offer was, tell me how much money you have left on your car loan. He knew personal information about myself related to some financial circumstances I was facing, as well as an ongoing custody battle that I was in for more time with my young daughter. And he said, you know, we could take care of all of that. We'll take care of you the same way they've taken care of me. You'll never have to worry about it again. You just give me this information. And I instantly just knew it was absolutely wrong. It made me feel sick to my stomach. And the more the conversation carried on, the dirtier it felt, but also the more worried and threatened I felt. This was somebody of great influence tied to someone of even greater influence telling me that he knew all of these personal things about me and he'd help me out if I just helped him. But what was deeper there, what was unspoken at the time, was, you know, in the back of my mind, what happens if I don't do this? What happens to my career?
Yeah. So you initially said no, correct?
Yes. So I actually, before the end of that meeting, I never had any intention of taking him up on that because I knew it was wrong. But I told him, give me the night to think about it and I'll be in touch tomorrow. And really what that was I knew I had to do something. I just didn't know what. I waited a few hours. I texted him later that afternoon and said, essentially my integrity was not for sale, that I wouldn't be the person that he had invested time and energy mentoring if I took him up on that, and that I was stepping back. And his response said it all. His response was, no matter what, don't ever tell anyone about this conversation.
Wow. But you contacted the feds and they had you wear a wire for another conversation.
Yes. I reached out. My best friend, after I talked with him, said, you need to do something about it. I have a contact. You should reach out. So I call a phone number and connected with who I now know as Special Agent Wetzel with the FBI, who asked, I gave him some high level details. And then he asked me to meet him the following day. And I agreed to it. I met with him, gave him every bit of information I had about that conversation. And he made a request. He said, we're not going to pressure you. We can't force you, but if you are willing, we'd like you to reapproach him about this conversation, take him up on his offer, and then wear a device to record those conversations. And so that, of course, resulted in several in-person meetings that were recorded, lots and lots of captured text messages, and then any phone conversation that we had, I had to record as well. So it produced quite a bit of recording.
So this is your former mentor, a friend, a person you admired, and you are wearing a wire. I mean, something straight out of Hollywood, and he's now convicted of bribery and racketeering. You didn't know that at the time, but that you knew he was doing something very wrong, which is why you went to federal investigators and why you opted to wear a wire. That had to be an incredibly tough choice. I mean, as morally sound as you might be, and you knowing, you know, as you say, you knew immediately this was wrong. It's quite a larger step to wear a wire on behalf of the FBI.
So I'll be really honest with you, and this may make me sound a little cold-hearted, but right when he transitioned from just catching up into offering me something for me doing something wrong in return, I knew that I was no longer dealing with a friend, that the person that I had known, who had invested in me, who I'd built a friendship with, I knew it was no longer him I was dealing with. And I was raised by two parents who literally just instilled in myself and my siblings to be good at what you do, to work as hard as you can to do it well, and to always, always, always do it for the right reasons. And in politics, that is sometimes exponentially more difficult than it is in other fields because it's dirty and it's gross. But I always felt that I could make a difference, that if I just did the right thing for the right reasons, I'd be successful. And my personal mantra became, and still is, people first, always. I had a really good friend who used to say, without people, politics, policy, all of that is completely meaningless. And so for me, the decision to record those conversations and cooperate with the FBI really was not difficult. It was scary, but it was not difficult because I knew that something wrong was taking place and I knew that I had an opportunity to expose it.
You mentioned it was scary. What, about a year passed between you wearing the wire and the arrest and indictments. What was that year like? Were you in contact with the FBI? Were you just waiting to see what would happen?
That year was hell. The campaign wrapped up at the end of October. I helped do some of the cleanup work afterwards through December and always was just kind of looking over my shoulder. The FBI kept in close contact. They would touch base and sometimes there were questions they had for me or they just wanted to check in and make sure I was doing all right. I was reassured that I was safe. If I noticed anything strange, I'd give them a call. But the hardest part of that period of time from October of 2021 until July of 20, or I'm sorry, October of 2019 until July of 2020 was that I couldn't tell anyone. I couldn't talk to anyone. And it was a weight that I was carrying by myself.
So then the charging documents came out in the summer of 2020, as we say, and your secret was out. And everyone suddenly knew that you were involved in this case, that you had worn a wire. You know, I guess first, what was your communication with Matt Borges at that time after the secret came out? Was there any?
Yeah, so the last direct contact I had with Matt Borges was, if I remember the date correctly, October 22nd of 2019. There was a hearing at the federal courthouse in Columbus about some of the aggressive tactics used in the campaign.
The signature blockers.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We were both at that hearing. We acknowledged one another. We had spoken at length, I think either that morning or the night before, in what is now sort of an infamous recorded phone call where he says, whatever you do, don't go to the hearing. If you're worried about them putting you on the stand, don't go. You just shouldn't go. Don't show up. Don't worry about it. And then keeps telling me the truth will set you free, which is highly ironic.
So he was afraid you were going to tell, if they called you to the stand, you're going to have to tell about this offer he made to you.
Yes. Yes. And so we acknowledged each other there and then that was it. No contact whatsoever. And so in July of 2020, when the charging documents came out, the arrests were made, actually the evening before, Agent Wetzel came to my house. I'll never forget this. I'll never forget so much of this, but knocked on the door and asked if we could go somewhere private to talk. So we went into my garage, which was closed, and we sat in, I refer to them as like soccer mom chairs, the folding ones that you take to your kid's game.
Very comfortable.
Yeah, yes, very. We sat in those, and he let me know. He said, there will be some arrests made tomorrow. Your name is not used in any of the charging documents. You are referred to as Confidential Human Source 1, or CHS-1. But you're the only person on the repeal campaign that worked for both Larry Householder and with Matt Borges. People will know. We're going to keep eyes on you. We'll stay in touch. The next morning, I was at the dentist and my phone just started absolutely blowing up. And it was text messages from people saying, oh my gosh, did you hear who got arrested? Did you see what happened? Have you heard the news? And then a little later that day, I was contacted by, we'll just say, a paper in Northwest Ohio, mm-hmm. who let me know that they knew it was me and they were going to publish a story with my identity, the identity of CHS-1, and asked if I had comment. I said no. But so by then, most people knew. A lot of people had reached out and said, are you all right? Are you safe? Fellow operatives, some legislators that I was close with, just checking in to make sure things were all right. But still, I couldn't say anything. The only thing I could do was acknowledge what had been said in those charging documents. And so I sat down with Jeremy Pelzer from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, did a short interview, but literally only referred back to my quotes from those documents. And for the next, you know, year plus, well, 2 years, actually, until testimony, I literally would just have to answer with anything you need to know has been recorded and published by the government.
Yeah.
And so that was when the story broke, it was crazy. I don't know if my phone has ever rung more, save when the verdict came out. I made some very unlikely friends. Believe it, James Carville reached out to me one night.
Interesting.
It's random.
It's a hilarious story, actually. He reached out. We built a very unlikely friendship. He wrote an article about me in The Hill, which is the most flattering thing that anyone has. He said some very flattering things about me. I was happy to read it, but still feel a little weird. But again, largely just had to remain quiet. Yeah. And so that burden was there for so long.
So you testified, you had a face, both Borges and Householder in court, and then the verdict came in. What did you think of that verdict?
Honestly, it was exactly what I had hoped for. Having been embroiled in this for so long, there's always that nervous feeling, right? You can't read the mind of a jury. You don't know what's going to happen. And even sitting in the courtroom during testimony, kind of watch them a little bit. And I had no ability to tell what was going on in their heads. I was nervous that maybe they wouldn't find them guilty, that something would happen, that words could be twisted. But when that verdict came out, it was vindicating because a jury of peers, part of the justice system and the legal process, literally heard the facts, the recordings, they saw the texts, all of that. And they came to the same conclusion that I had known was true for so long. Mm-hmm. So it was, again, so relieving. After the arrests were made, you know, I felt slightly better because it was like, all right, justice is being served. There's a process now. And I didn't realize until the verdict came out that I think there was still a level of anxiety related to this kind of running in the background. And when that verdict came out, I felt it completely wash away. You know, Matt Borges spent quite a bit of time going on sort of a PR campaign on his own behalf over the last couple of years. A lot of that time was spent saying very demeaning and hurtful things about me, whether as a professional or personal things. He published copies of my social security card and tax documents on his legal defense website. And then claimed it was an accident. And in politics, in any industry, but especially in politics, when someone makes claims about you and says things about your character or your professionalism, you always have the ability to respond. And I did not.
Yeah, you couldn't.
It was a huge relief.
There was a point when you were good friends with Matt Borges, and this is all so strange. I mean, what are your thoughts on him now? Do you think it was just the money that got to him, or how did this happen?
You know, I wish I fully knew. I have some guesses. The Matt that I knew was kind to the people around him. He went out of his way on numerous occasions to give me great opportunities to make sure that I had opportunities in front of me that would benefit me professionally and personally, none of which were ever shady. They were just good opportunities for a young political operative. My Sunday afternoons and a lot of time during the week were spent texting back and forth with him about New England Patriots football. I was born and raised a Patriots fan, and Matt had grown up in the Northeast and was the same.
Same here. Much to Steve Brown's chagrin.
Yeah, I'm a Browns fan. He's the cocky Pats fan.
That's right.
there are still a few of us.
Yes.
He went to the Super Bowl in February of 2019. He brought me back a hat. We were close. I sought him for counsel on decisions I was making. And the only reason this took place, I can't stress this enough, the only reason that this situation ever occurred is because of our friendship. He expected blind loyalty, like so many in politics do, and thought I would go along with it. I think what happened was what happens to so many people in politics. Matt got in so deep and got so comfortable with the money, with the gifts, with being, quote unquote, taken care of. He got in so deep that when he was faced with an opportunity to either do the right or wrong thing, he chose the wrong thing in the interest of self-preservation and money and power.
Yeah. You know, this whole case is really, I hate to use the cliche, but I'll use it anyway, peel back the curtain on how politics, at least in this case, is done in Ohio. The influence mm-hmm. of money, big corporations in politics in Ohio. Is that the way it is, Tyler? Is that the way it is in every matter? How can we not be, as observers, outside observers, anything but cynical that this is the way it works at the Ohio State House?
Yeah, I'm going to be really honest with you. I'd been involved in politics in Ohio since I can remember. I was a weird kid. In middle school, my buddies would say, hey, we're going to go play paintball this weekend. Do you want to come? And I'd say, no, I've got to knock on doors and make phone calls for a candidate, right? By 2016, I became extremely disenchanted with Ohio politics. I was just over it. The way things had gone, the way people were behaving, it was giving me putting a bad taste in my mouth. By the time all of this rolled around, by the time House Bill 6 was passed and we started the repeal campaign, the curtain had been pulled back for me in a lot of ways. And I started moving away from wanting to be involved in electoral politics because of the amount of dark money, because of, you know, this for somebody that, and maybe I'm naive on some level or was, but you see one party, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, one party takes power. They essentially have a free pass to get things done, especially with a supermajority. It's an opportunity for positive progress that impacts people's lives every day. But what we saw take place in Ohio was the opposite. And it's still happening. Look at what's going on at the State House now with leadership fights and people throwing fits. You have all of this opportunity to do something good. And instead you spend it bickering with one another and fighting about who gets to sit where. All the while, parts of House Bill 6 are still in place. They're still in place. And the people at the top levels, not just the legislature, have remained completely silent and have acted like they had no idea about anything that was going on during all of this. I don't buy it. I think that it is absolutely the worst form of poor leadership, and it's a stain on Ohio. I'm in Minnesota now. Things are a little different here when it comes to campaign expenditures and other things. There's a tighter grip on what takes place. I think there needs to be a large focus from the legislature, from the governor's office, from others in Ohio, a large focus placed on anti-corruption laws to make sure that this stuff does not happen again. But my faith in that happening is so low because that curtain's been pulled back.
Tyler Furman, the man who wore a wire to record conversations with Matt Borges, who, along with Larry Householder, has been convicted of bribery and racketeering in the largest corruption scandal in Ohio history. Tyler Furman, thank you so much for taking time out to join Snollygoster.
Yeah, Tyler, let me just say we are named our podcast after Snollygoster, which is a shrewd, selfish politician. I think we can safely say you are exactly the opposite of that. And we thank you for your time today and for what you've done.
Well, I appreciate that. Y'all have a great day. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast, White Lies.
Welcome back to Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. What a conversation there. James Carville writing an article about him in The Hill. I had no idea. It's going to be a movie someday.
Could be. Hopefully. I mean, he did the right thing.
It seems like it, yeah.
I mean, Matt Borges claims that it wasn't a bribe. Jury thought otherwise. But, you know, he's stuck with his integrity. He's remaining active in politics, not necessarily the same he was doing here in Ohio. He's a big advocate for renewable energy, and he seems to be living his best life in Minnesota, and we wish him the best.
Yeah, we absolutely do. A quick update now on some other big political stories we've been following. The Ohio Ballot Board this week approved proposed constitutional amendment language for the November ballot. That's if supporters can gather the more than 400,000 valid petition signatures they need by early July.
Abortion rights opponents did not waste any time getting a video ad out there, a TV ad. It claims the amendment would revoke parental rights to play a role in their daughter's abortion or gender-affirming care. They probably have a case to be made on the parental consent for abortion part. We're not so sure about the gender-affirming care part. Calling that reproductive health care could be a stretch.
Yeah, just to catch listeners up, this proposed amendment, if approved, would enshrine abortion rights into the Ohio Constitution up to the point of fetal viability, which is the standard that the old Roe versus Wade ruling used. Also, the state of Ohio, as we thought, suing Norfolk Southern. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost announced the suit this week. The state is seeking an unspecified amount of damages for the East Palestine derailment. Yost says, without giving an exact figure, it would be a lot.
Yes, lots. Lots and lots.
A lot of money.
All right, time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the week.
This week, Senator Jerry Serino of Kirtland in Northeast Ohio proposed a sweeping bill basically telling Ohio's public colleges and universities what they can and cannot do.
The bill would prohibit employees from striking. It would ban partnerships with Chinese universities. It would end diversity training mandates. And it would mandate that all public college students in Ohio take U.S. history.
This is where Senator Serino earns our Snollygoster Award. We can debate intellectual diversity on campus. That is a debate worth having. But he wants to put into state law the mandatory reading list for history classes.
That list includes the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, that's a short one, the Emancipation Proclamation, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail.
What about Lincoln's second inaugural address?
I know.
What about Common Sense, FDR's first inaugural, John Kasich's Two Paths?
That's a classic in American political literature.
John
Why
Kasich,
not?
Get on the bus or get out of the way.
That's right. So, for putting a history syllabus into state law, or at least trying to, Senator Jerry Serino, you get our Snollygoster of the
Week.
It's
all about academic freedom, Mike. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcast, and tell your friends about us. For our audio producer, Eric French, and our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.